The guidelines came out in 75 and are updated periodically. They tend to be rather general. For expert testimony, it has to be based upon sufficient facts or data. Testimony has to be the product of reliable principles and methods, and the expert witness has to have applied the principles and methods reliably to the facts of the case. So how did we get this idea on saturated fat to begin with? Where does this come from? Well, Ansel Keys, who did the six-country study, and he showed this good correlation between consumption of fat and coronary heart disease in the six countries. A paper was published by a professor at Berkeley, and Hillebo was the director of health at New York State. They pointed out that there were other countries that could have been looked at, France, where you have high fat intake and low cardiovascular disease. And the point here is that the testimony was not based on sufficient data. Okay, so we'll look at seven countries. Keyes did that. What he found was that the highest consumption of fat was associated with the highest incidence of cardiovascular disease in Finland and also the lowest in Crete. And this is where we got the idea of a Mediterranean diet and that saturated fat was a problem. If you looked at a different county in Finland, you got different results than Keyes got. And most important, somebody wrote a letter to the editor pointing out that 60% of the study participants on Crete were fasting during the 40 days of Lent and had periodic abstention from meat, fish, dairy products, eggs and cheese, as well as abstention from olive oil periodically. This was not noted in the study, and no attempt was made to differentiate between fasters and non-fasters. In our view, this was a remarkable and troublesome omission. So there's a question whether this expert witness has applied the principles and methods reliably to the facts of the case, as required by the federal guidelines. This should not have been admitted in evidence. However, it is still quoted, for example, by the American Dietetic Association for reducing saturated fat. The real problem is that you have to show that diet directly affects outcome, and this was undertaken in the Framingham study, which in the end found that there was no relation between diet and cardiovascular disease, no effect of fat, no effect of saturated fat. And at that time, you could bury the data. So the information was not published for many years. It's now available in what looks like a mimeographed sheet for $80 from the federal government. Mike Eads, the author of Protein Power, bought a copy. When he told me, I said he should have called me because our library has a copy, but he said no, it was worth it because stuck inside of his copy was this clipping. Admitted there was no discernible relationship between diet intake and serum cholesterol. Not only none between serum cholesterol, but none in the final outcome. There was no reduction in cardiovascular disease in the lower saturated fat. And the director of the Framingham study said it should not be interpreted that diet has no connection with blood cholesterol. Well, what he's really saying is, by analogy again with a court of law, is you can't be found innocent. You can only be found not guilty. You can't prove a theory in science. All you can do is show that the data are not consistent with the theory. So the mother of all low-fat failures is the Women's Health Initiative, which found that over a mean of 8 years, a dietary intervention reducing total fat intake, increased intakes of vegetables, fruits, and grains did not significantly reduce the risk of coronary heart disease, stroke, or cardiovascular disease in postmenopausal women. The Women's Health Initiative followed on a large number of studies, the Mr. Fit, Honolulu study. They all gave, at best, ambiguous results and were generally failures. As soon as this came out, Elizabeth Nabel, the director of National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, was on television saying that nothing has changed. Some wit on the internet said the Women's Health Initiative report gave rise to a whole new field called excusonomics. there's a whole industry in criticizing the classic is Uffe Ravenskopf's cholesterol myths, an excellent book that has a very succinct and trenchant description of the problem is The Rise and Fall of Modern Medicine by James LeFanu. There are two books with the same title. Presumably nobody could pass up the pun on the great cholesterol con. The most captivating, of course, is Gary Taubes's Good Calories, Bad Calories, which gives an excellent description of the history. We know where Hannah Sutter is coming from the title. What's interesting about this, though, is that there are no rebuttals. This is really the party line. This is the official position of the government, and it's been criticized. And I only know of one rebuttal, and that's The Cholesterol Wars by Daniel Steinberg, which is an excellent book, but unconvincing. And it's the subtitle of his book that's very interesting. Skeptics versus the preponderance of evidence. Now, the preponderance of evidence is a phrase that is attached to conviction in civil court. It's a far more limited criterion for conviction. And it contrasts substantially with the consensus statement in 1985 that the problem was beyond a reasonable doubt, the criterion for criminal conviction. So we've come a long way in terms of what we're going to accept. Federal Rule of Evidence, one of the interesting rules is Rule 403, which says that relevant evidence can still be excluded if its probative value is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. Now, generally, as I understand it, this is used in court to keep lawyers from showing the jury too many pictures of the dismembered corpse to have an emotional effect. But we might consider it in the context of the conclusions of the Dietary Guidelines Committee that the consumption of certain fats, such as saturated fatty acids and trans fatty acids, is associated with a poor lipid profile and increased risk of cardiovascular disease. If you go to the American Heart website, you can see a truly terrible movie showing the villainy of trans and saturated fats, and it criticizes just about everything we eat, from steak to cherry pie. Is this unfair prejudice? Trans fat, as Dr. McNamara showed, is to some extent our own invention and is, in any case, an industrial side product, which everybody agrees, let's get rid of it. Saturated fat is a natural part of the diet. If you don't eat it, your body will make saturated fat. It's prejudicing the jury to lump these two things together. Well, this is the key decision in scientific evidence in federal court. Daubert and his co-plaintiff were born with serious birth defects. They claimed that Bendectin, an anti-nausea drug, which was taken by their mother during pregnancy, caused the birth defects. The evidence was not admissible under the Fry standard of general acceptance, and ultimately appeal was made to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld the decision, but took the occasion to examine what do we really mean by scientific evidence. The court invoked numbers of philosophers of science, notably Karl Popper, who's generally credited with establishing the standard that the status of a scientific theory is that it's falsifiable, that you can actually disprove it. One of the legal scholars, Margaret Berger, boiled this down to say that Daubert could be succinctly described as a new two-pronged test. Scientific evidence had to be reliable and relevant. Reliable meant that the conclusions were derived from hypothesis testing, peer review and publication, known or potential rates of error, and standards controlling the technique's operation. General acceptance was still part of the picture, but it was no longer dispositive in any case. So, is the case against saturated fat falsifiable? Will we ever accept anything as evidence? Well, let's look at the Nutrition Evidence Library. There are a number of papers. Let's look at Berglund. They directly compared the effect of monounsaturated fat as a replacement for saturated fat with carbohydrates as a root. So they're going to replace saturated fat either with monounsaturated fat or with carbohydrate in people with high metabolic risk profiles. They found that, in fact, LDL was lower in both groups if carbohydrate used to replace saturated fat or if monounsaturated fat. And their conclusion was monounsaturated fat provided a greater reduction in risk as a replacement for saturated fat than carbohydrate. And I would say that this is an exaggeration because when you look at the actual data, that replacing saturated fat had a very bad effect on HDL and triglycerides, and this was greatly exacerbated if you used carbohydrate to replace saturated fat. And this is borne out in lots of other studies that replacing saturated fat with carbohydrate is not clearly beneficial, and in most cases is generally bad. As Dr. McNamara said, we've known for 60 years that you increase carbohydrate, triglycerides go up. There's something positive in this, and that is that a lot of the population recognizes that they may have to make decisions for themselves. And if they look at the primary data, there's at best no risk in replacing carbohydrate in their diet with saturated fat. And in fact, there's almost surely a real benefit. On a Daubert challenge, we would ask, are these data really reliable? Do they really line up with the conclusion? Let's look at another Jacobson's meta-analysis. A bunch of different studies collected together. The pooled data is then analyzed, and I wanted to say two things because the reliability of the methodology here is really critical. And I would question what we get out of these meta-analyses. And I see it as analogous to the emerging country that was trying to decide whether its railroad should have tracks of the gauge that meshed with the gauge of the railroad of the country to the north or the gauge of the railroad with the country to the south. And their parliament finally decided that they would have a track gauge that was the mean of the two. All of these are really weak data. And if you pool them, what do you expect to get? weak data. These kinds of low risks are actually almost the same as odds ratio or relative risk, which means what you think. It's the risk if you keep the saturated fat versus divided by the risk if you change to either polyunsaturated or carbohydrate. So if it's one, it means there's no benefit either way. You're just as likely to have a coronary event or coronary death with the replacement as you are without the replacement. So a hazard ratio of one means you know just what you knew before you turned on the TV. So there's no information in a hazard ratio of one. Now, the technical point is that associated with this is a so-called 95% confidence interval. It's a parameter for how reliable the data is. The bottom line is that if the error bar, if the 95% confidence interval crosses one, that is, if the interval of error crosses equal probability, then the data is not significant. Then you can't admit it into evidence, and the jury should not consider it. All of these studies have that feature. These are studies going back to the 80s showing that there was no effect of replacement of saturated fat. Why did they persist? And if you take the average, you can get them to come out so that they're, you know, you have the track gauge of the mean, but it just doesn't mean anything. So the idea of replacing saturated fat with unsaturated fat is more effective in decreasing cardiovascular risk than is reducing total fat. It actually may be true. You just can't tell it from this data.